From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
A Senate showdown over Democratic election legislation as the Republican Party intends to revamp the process for presidential debates. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We're joined today by my colleagues, columnist Kim Strassel and editorial writer Jason Willick. Despite little hope of success, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer is pushing forward with an effort to change the Senate's rules to pass a bill that amounts to a federal election code. We don't know exact timing, but some of the reporting this morning suggests that there could be a cloture vote on the bill at around 6:30 this evening with more drama to follow. Kim, do you have a sense of how you expect this whole thing to play out?
The weird thing is that everybody knows how all this is going to play out. And so it doesn't make any sense that Chuck Schumer is going ahead with this. It's been very clear for months now that Senator Joe Manchin and Senator Kyrsten Sinema have no intention of voting ultimately to break the rules and to get rid of the filibuster. And so the only purpose in doing this, as Chuck Schumer has said himself, is to make them go out on the floor and vote it down, to humiliate them and to potentially, I guess, put them at greater odds with their party. It seems to be a strategy born out of rage and retribution, perhaps born out of Mr. Schumer's desire to stand with progressives and ward off a primary threat to himself back in New York. But it is not a strategy at all designed to actually get an end result or a legislative victory, which is what makes it so perplexing.
And Joe Manchin has answered this question about 1,000 times by now. And on Tuesday, he answered it for what must be the 1,001th time. Here's what he said. The majority of my colleagues in the Democratic caucus have changed their minds. I respect that. They have a right to change their minds. I haven't. I hope they respect that, too. I've never changed my mind on the filibuster. Jason, he also said that he would welcome a primary challenge if one arrived in West Virginia on the basis of his filibuster vote. But I suspect that Joe Manchin knows the West Virginia electorate a little bit better than Chuck Schumer does.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what is going on with this Senate thing. I mean, we had weeks of windup that we're going to break the filibuster to pass the elections bill. And then Kyrsten Sinema went on the Senate floor and said, I'm not going to do that. So you don't have 50 votes to do that. And then now they said, well, what if we break the filibuster to pass the elections bill? And it's not going to happen. And this notion of primary challengers for Joe Manchin, again, it's just detached from reality. Joe Manchin is the person who makes Chuck Schumer the majority leader. He's the median senator that he gives Chuck Schumer the majority leader title from West Virginia. The alternative to Joe Manchin is a Republican and Mitch McConnell being majority leader. West Virginia voted for Trump by almost 40 points. So we're going to punish Joe Manchin by replacing him with a Republican so that we're in the minority. I mean, after trying to break the filibuster in the majority, after you're told you can't do it, I mean, it's just looks ridiculous to me. I honestly can't understand it.
Well, one possible answer is that Chuck Schumer thought that he could back off on the proposed rule change enough that he could pick up some votes. So now he's talking about reportedly what he will ask for tonight is a carve out combined with a talking filibuster. So not the end of the filibuster, not no filibuster for this legislation, but a talking filibuster. And here's a clip of Schumer on Tuesday.
If the Senate cannot protect the right to vote, which is the cornerstone of our democracy, then the Senate rules must be reformed. Must be reformed. If the Republicans block cloture on the legislation before us, I will put forward a proposal to change the rules to allow for a talking filibuster on this legislation, as recommended by a number of our colleagues who have been working on this reform for a long time.
So maybe he thought that Joe Manchin in the end would come along for a talking filibuster. But Kim, how would this kind of talking filibuster work? And would that give Schumer what he really wants, which is easy passage of this bill?
We saw Democrats begin floating this strategy actually last year. They saw Joe Manchin go on TV and say, well, I don't want to get rid of the filibuster, but I would be open to reforming the filibuster. And suddenly that was all the rage with all kinds of proposals. And the talking filibuster became the favorite idea. And the idea behind it is that the minority party has the ability to stand up and continue to filibuster a bill by talking and talking and talking. But once they run out of energy and once they've gone through a couple of rotations, that then comes to an end and you get to have a vote on a majority rule vote, meaning 50 votes. So in essence, it's still killing the filibuster. And that's interesting because Joe Manchin has said that therefore he would not support it for use in the final version of the vote. So let me put it this way. He said he's open to at various times during the debate on a bill, there are different cloture votes where you need 60 votes. He said he'd be willing earlier in the process to allow a talking filibuster and therefore maybe get on a debate and have more debate on an issue. But he's also made very clear he would not support that as the final vote of a bill. Therefore, he is still going to demand that the final vote on any bill requires 60 votes. So that's a little bit complex in terms of the technicality of how the filibuster works. So, I mean, Chuck Schumer might have thought that this was a way to go forward, but not really, in that Manchin has been very clear that he was never going to allow that reform to change the fundamental premise of the filibuster, which is that you need 60 votes to pass a bill into law. So here was him quoted just this week again. He said, quote, "I love the talking filibuster," but then added, "There's never been a simple majority vote to get off of a debate." So he's saying he won't use it to finish up a bill. So there's no change in the end. And that's not what Democrats want. In a way, this was a bit of a game. They were hoping to give Joe Manchin cover to essentially get rid of the filibuster while saying he wasn't really getting rid of the filibuster. He was just reforming it. He's no dope, and he didn't fall for that.
But even if you had a talking filibuster, I mean, there's a reason that the Senate got rid of that in the first place. And it's true that a talking filibuster puts a burden on the minority party that is trying to block a piece of legislation, which is somebody has to be standing there reading from the dictionary at all times. But it also puts huge burdens on the majority party that is trying to pass the legislation. So there's one person who, one member of the minority holding the floor, but you need 50 members of the majority at all times in the chamber to have a quorum. Otherwise, the person who's reading from the dictionary says, Mr. Parliamentarian, it looks like we don't have enough people in here to do business right now. And meanwhile, while they're reading from the dictionary, nothing else gets done. The minority party can burn weeks and weeks and weeks, and there's no other bills passing. There's no judges that are getting confirmed. There's none of, President Biden's other appointees who are getting confirmed. And so, Jason, there's a reason that they got rid of this in the first place, which is that it wasn't working all that well. And so I'm also a little bit perplexed why Schumer seems to think that this is the answer to his problems.
Yeah. I mean, as Kim says, you can argue about the technicalities of the Senate rules and make it a little harder or a little bit less hard, and make it so that, you can't just press a button maybe and filibuster, force the party filibustering to actually do something. But the bottom line is, when you strip away all the technicalities and all the Senate rules, is can you pass legislation in the Senate when a party has 50 votes in the Senate on a party line vote with no buy-in from the opposition party? The filibuster is intended to ensure you can't do that. And that's what it's doing now. And, no amount of sort of weird procedural gamesmanship will change that. It sort of reminds me of fantasies about, Mueller is going to invoke this law and the marshal of the Supreme Court is going to do this or that. Sort of just liberal fantasies about the rules that don't get around the hard political reality. And so in this case, you wrote a partisan election bill without trying to get Susan Collins, without trying to get Mitt Romney, without trying to address even any of the vulnerabilities in the 2020 election. It's just a pure partisan bill. And so you can't pass it in a 50-50 Senate. And nothing's going to change that. And I assume that today we're going to see that. And the big question to me is, what comes after the party's donors and activists have pushed it to this display, this theatrics that they're going to put on today? What happens after that? Because reality is going to set in. You can't do it.
Meanwhile, while Schumer is making this push, the Republican leader Mitch McConnell is arguing that even if it fails, even if the effort to do a carve out of the filibuster fails, that trying to do it is corrosive. Listen to this.
Too many of our colleagues across the aisle still want to respond to a 50-50 Senate with a rule-breaking power grab. Voting to break this institution will not be a free vote or a harmless action, even if their effort fails. An unprincipled attempt at grabbing power is not harmless just because it fails. Voting to break the Senate is not cost-free just because a bipartisan majority of your colleagues have the wisdom to stop you.
Kim, what do you make of that argument? I mean, at the very least, it does seem to me that trying to break the rules, even if you don't succeed, makes it more likely that the other party or your party later on will try to break the rules again.
Oh, I couldn't agree more, although I would argue that the danger of all of this came last year, or 2 years ago, rather, during the Democratic primary, when all of the candidates for president mainstreamed this idea, notably all of them other than essentially Joe Biden, who held off on endorsing this idea, but now, as in so many different areas, has just been bullied by the progressives to jumping on board with this and is also demanding that the institution that he served in for decades be broken in the cause of partisan ambition. So it's pretty remarkable, and it's very scary because, look, right now, yeah, we have a Joe Manchin, we have a Kyrsten Sinema, they are holding strong. But it's also extremely rare that you have a Senate that is so evenly divided. Usually parties end up with 53, 54, 55 votes. And if the Republicans win the Senate in the midterms, as many people are hoping or predicting, then the country is likely to be spared for some years longer the threat of the end of the filibuster and a change in the Senate. But Democrats have now signaled that this would be one of their top priorities if they next regained a majority. And there's a higher potential, just given the way that Senate seats are distributed and how elections work, that if they came in next time, they'd have a bigger majority. And they might have the numbers to do this. So does that mean that its days are numbered? Unclear. I mean, I think that one thing that has changed, though, is that by actually holding a vote on this, they have now turned it into a key question in every future Senate race, which is meaning that candidates are going to be asked this explicitly. Do you support this or not? And we'll see the American will on that. You know, this could potentially be a damaging to a number of Democrats going forward. Look, just immediate casualty. Mark Kelly, who's up for election in Arizona, had managed to successfully dodge the question of whether or not he'd break the filibuster all the way up until today. But now he finally had to declare himself. He said that he would break it. He will vote with the rest of his party. That's going to be used against him and hard in his upcoming race.
One last thought on this. We've talked a little about why Schumer is going on this doomed mission. And we have an email here from Michael in Virginia. He suggests that it may be perceived by Senator Schumer as necessary to show the left, who may support AOC in a Dem primary this year against him, that he is on their side. That strikes me as quite a likely reason for this, unquote. Jason, what do you make of that? Is Senator Schumer here worried about a primary challenge from the left?
Probably. So he can show them. So he'll do the vote and show them. And what are they going to get out of it? They're going to get the next 54 vote Republican majority breaking the filibuster and driving through a bunch of priorities that they don't like. So it's just incredibly self-defeating. I think certainly Schumer is worried about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez running for Senate in New York, but he's the majority leader of the United States Senate. You know, and I guess people are debating what are the explanations for this. My explanation has to be that people has to go back to taking people at their word in addition to their politicians, so they have political calculations. But I do take them at their word that they've been convinced that the stakes are so huge that you just try, even if it'll fail, because you're on the right side of history and history will look on you positively, and it's an issue like slavery and so on. So I think there's political calculations, and there's also just the fact of the matter of how polarized we are and how Democrats are truly convinced of, in my view, a totally hyperbolic sense of the stakes here.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
Your Money Briefing will explore what you need to know to become a homeowner and how to sustain your home by learning ways to manage the costs from unexpected expenses.
You're basically always in a state of checking. You're always keeping your eye open for anything that could be going wrong with your house. Your house is a complicated machine. It has a lot of systems and components in it, and those systems and components are getting older. They're wearing out.
You can get early access to our series, Buying a Home and Keeping It, on WSJ Special Access, only for WSJ subscribers.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. Another interesting bit of political news. Last week, the Republican National Committee said it would begin requiring presidential candidates who want the party's nomination to pledge that they will not participate in debates sponsored by the Commission on Presidential Debates. That was a nonprofit that was set up in 1987 to manage presidential debates. And here's RNC Chairman Ronna McDaniel explaining why.
The debate commission had debates start after 26 states started voting. They picked a moderator that had worked for Joe Biden, and then they switched one of the debates to virtual to let Joe Biden stay in the basement. So Republicans know when we have a free and fair forum and when we have an exchange of ideas, we win. That's why we said to the debate commission, we want to guarantee that debates will start before 26 states start voting. They said, no thanks, we don't want to work with you. And now we're going to go fight to give our nominee that fair forum that they deserve.
Kim, what do you make of this move by the Republican Party?
I support it. Look, I'd be more than happy to see this commission go away. Just a little bit of background here. It was formed in 1987, and it was formed with the assent of both of the party chairmen at the time. And the notion behind it, it was a very high-minded goal, is that you bring some sort of nonpartisan uniformity to debate rules. The problem is that it has become very partisan over time, or certainly tilted more so that way. You just heard Ron McDaniel give some examples of how the RNC felt put upon in the last presidential election. More generally, as many of us know, having watched this operation over the years, its moderators increasingly tend to tilt toward the left. Their choice of subjects is often asinine. They come up with all these kind of supposed fact-checking points and that tend to favor Democrats and disfavor Republicans. But, you know, the general point here, though, is that we have presidential contests, fine, right up until 1988. People were, the parties were totally capable of coming up with their own rules. So there are people out there that worry, well, if you don't have this commission, you won't have any presidential debates. But no, let the parties come together, let them negotiate the terms and the times and the moderators and come to some sort of agreement. And, you know, if one side says they don't want to go there, they don't want to debate, the voters can decide whether or not that speaks well or badly of them. But, you know, the notion that we need some body of you know, preeminent political experts and poobahs to come up with the rules and impose them on all sides, it just isn't going to fly anymore.
Well, let me give the other side its due. Here's Mitt Romney speaking. He was asked about this recently. He's a guy who knows something about debates. He said, in my own view, that would be nuts. The American people want to hear from the nominees of the two respective parties. It's a good chance to understand their views and to see them in a high-pressure situation, unquote. Jason, what do you make of that?
Well, I think he's right that the American people want to see nominees debate. But as Kim said, that's not a necessity of the presidential debate commission. It doesn't depend on the debate commission. The first debate, televised debate, famously, was between Richard Nixon and John F. Kennedy in 1960. There was no debate commission then. These things can be negotiated without a centralized commission. I think that the move to drop the commission is part of a wider trend of centralized institutions sort of losing their hold on things, whether it's the major TV networks losing ground to social media. In our networked world and world of Twitter, people have a way of getting around these old-fashioned gatekeepers, and it's pretty natural that the Presidential Debate Commission is going to be a casualty of that because it doesn't add so much more value in terms of format or structure than what the candidates could do on their own. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I do think it would be unfortunate if debates didn't happen because I'm a believer that they're helpful, but I don't think that this is surprising as a just sort of reflection of the trends in politics and technology.
Well, I do think that some of the critics are misreading what's happening here, and maybe Romney is one of those. I do wonder what the question that was actually put to him was. Here's another headline I'll pick out. It's at 538. It says, what does it mean if Republicans won't debate? And Kim, to your points, I don't think the RNC is saying that they don't want debates. They're saying they want the debates to be organized by the parties, or at least they want the commission to take more input from the parties. So it's possible that this move is a negotiating tactic to get the RNC a little bit of more leverage. The question, though, is without the commission, let's say the bipartisan commission falls by the wayside, doesn't every year or every presidential year turn into a game of chicken between the two nominees? One nominee says, I want four debates. One nominee says, I want six debates. They argue about the rules. They argue if they should be town halls, who the moderator should be. And then you have a lot of uncertainty about whether there will be actually any debates. And the commission, the bipartisan commission, is intended, at least it was built to be, sort of a trusted third party to help smooth those negotiations.
Well, to your point about this being a negotiating tactic, I think that that, in fact, might be the case, because the RNC has, for ever since the 2020 election, in fact, even prior to that, been pushing for reforms to the Presidential Debate Commission. The commission has somewhat high-handedly just dismissed all those, not really taken any of them on board. This seems to be a way for the RNC to say, look, we really mean it, and if you can't make some changes, even modest changes, we're out. In terms of those people that are really worried, oh, you know, we're not going to hear from the candidates, and oh dear, we won't have any debates. To a certain extent, not having any debates would actually be preferable to the weirdness of, for instance, the 2020 debates, where you only had half of the country. By the way, half of the country didn't really get to see the candidates before they went to go vote, because they didn't have the first debate until after that early voting had begun. Do you remember in those closing days up until the election, as you finally had some of the revelations about Hunter Biden, Joe Biden's son? There were all of these Google searches for how do I change my vote? And, you know, that's no way to manage a democracy either. The way that things are done at many of the state levels, for instance, governor's debates, is, yeah, both sides have to agree to the format and the number and the time and the place. And often you do go back and forth, and sometimes they don't even get to a solution. Often you see that the person who's often ahead in the polls or an incumbent, those are the ones who don't want to have a debate because the risk of having mistakes. But as I mentioned, voters get to calculate this in. If they feel someone's being too chicken to go out there and actually debate their record and talk about their proposals, then that might factor into how they vote. And one last point here, too. Increasingly, in a day and age where we have wall-to-wall news coverage, where we have political ads that people are so sick of by the end of the day, that are on their TV and radio and social media at every minute, that's a way for people to get their message out, too. It's not the same as a debate, but we're a long way away from the days when there was one little local newspaper or three broadcast stations, and that was the only place to ever see anything about a candidate. There's lots of ways to get information.
Yeah, I do think that's a fair point. My last thought here is just that we don't know if this is a negotiating tactic. But if it's not, it could make 2024 particularly interesting, because you could have a Republican nominee who has pledged not to take part in any commission debates, and you could have a commission that is still trying to fulfill its role and is organizing debates. And the Democratic nominee will, of course, try to say, we should have these commission debates. That's going to be the Democratic stance. And so then the Republican nominee, Jason, is going to be asked, do you go back on your pledge and agree to the commission debates, or do you stick to your pledge to the Republican voters and try to negotiate something outside that and kill off the bipartisan commission for good? It could be a very interesting turn of events, and Jason will give you the last word.
Yeah, I mean, nobody wants it to turn into our wider sort of bipartisan relations, where often there's just no agreement to be had and just delaying and stonewalling. So it's nice in that sense to have structure. As Kim pointed out, it sounds like Ronna McDaniel's complaint, one of them, was mail-in voting, you know, which makes this all the more charged because that's a controversial issue. But one of the reasons that Republicans prefer in-person voting is that everybody votes at the same time with the same information. But I wouldn't be surprised if the debate commission budged a little bit and said, okay, you guys are concerned about this widespread voting ahead of the debates, we'll move it up a little bit to accommodate you. But gosh, if, as you say, it goes into 2024 without this resolved, it's kind of like who blinks first, and then it's just going to depend on the personalities of the candidates. But as Kim says, you know, as long as we're in a competitive political environment, which we very much are, people have to respond to public perception. And so there's not really a risk in my mind that we have market forces, as it were, that are trying to compel a resolution here, political market forces. So I think it'll turn out okay.
Thank you, Jason and Kim. Thank you all for listening. You can email us at pwpodcast@wsj.com. And if you like the show, please hit that subscribe button on your favorite podcast app. We'll be back tomorrow with another edition of Potomac Watch.